The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's hard to overstate the toll of alcohol abuse. It's a huge factor in so many problems, from car crashes to domestic violence to homicide. Here in New Hampshire, the worry is especially around teens and young adults who have high rates of binge drinking compared to the rest of the country. And another long concern here has been our state's relative lack of substance abuse treatment. Low state resources dedicated to addiction are often blamed. For example, a specific alcohol and drug treatment fund set up more than a decade ago has been raided almost every year for other budgetary purposes. Meanwhile, at the national level, there's an emerging debate over the effectiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous, long considered a refuge for people struggling with alcohol addiction. Today in The Exchange, we take a new look at an old problem, alcohol abuse, the toll and the treatments. And let's hear from you. Have you or someone you know struggled with this? What are your thoughts on treatment, what works and what doesn't, and how state policies play into this issue of alcoholism? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Cheryl Pacapelli is here. She's director of Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, a statewide recovery community organization. Cheryl, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Tim Rourke, Director of Program Department and Substance Use Disorders, Grantmaking for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, Director of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. And Tim, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura.
Well, Tim, it's been a while since we actually talked about alcohol. We've been focusing so much on heroin, and rightly so. It's a rising epidemic. We've talked a lot about marijuana, concerns about that. What about alcohol, though, Tim? Where does New Hampshire sit right now in terms of alcohol use and abuse?
That's a really good question. And I think, you know, it's important for folks to understand that while we are talking about these other issues that are a little more high profile, alcohol issues are the sort of monster under the bed in terms of we have incredibly high rates of use of alcohol. About a third of our young people use alcohol on a regular basis. We have some of the highest rates of binge drinking, which is a lot of alcohol in a short period of time, particularly among young adults in the United States. And from a health outcome standpoint, alcohol kills more people than all other drugs combined. So it's not only an issue of high rates of use, but the disorders and diseases and health implications of high levels of alcohol use really impact health outcomes for a lot of people in the state of New Hampshire.
So alcohol kills more people combined than heroin, marijuana, cocaine, whatever you want to call it.
That's correct. And usually whether it is, again, through a drunk driving accident or an accident under the influence or diseases that are caused by overexposure to alcohol, cirrhosis of the liver, or cancers, things of that nature.
I want to get some definitions out of the way early on before we get into, you know, all the policies and discussions around treatment. So, Tim, what's alcohol abuse, misuse, an alcoholic? Because these three terms are thrown around a lot.
Sure. So much like substance use disorders in general, it falls along a continuum. So we look at how individuals are using alcohol. Are they using it in a way that negatively impacts their quality of life? Do they use in spite of that negative impact? And then do you see other health challenges related to their use? And depending on the answers to those questions, that's where we look at maybe there's someone who is misuses alcohol. So a young person under the legal drinking age who is drinking, someone who hides their drinking behavior. Maybe they haven't yet had some of the other health negative health outcomes. Maybe they haven't touched law enforcement yet. So you look at both how they use alcohol, the consequences that they face, and whether or not they're using it to a point where there are physical withdrawal symptoms. You know, folks who are alcoholic at the deep end of the continuum, alcohol withdrawal is very dangerous. You know, it can actually kill people. So we really look to the way in which alcohol is impacting the body. So it's a continuum of disorders. But we get concerned when you see people at that misuse stage. That's where we need to start paying attention, because they're either hiding their use, they're using it in ways in which, or in environments in which they should not, and they are not in a position where they feel like they want to stop necessarily.
So is somebody who binge drinks a couple times a month with their friends, and binge drinking is defined as five drinks or more at one sitting, so you're getting kind of drunk there. If somebody does that a couple times a month with their friends on the weekend, but otherwise, you know, doesn't have any impacts in terms of work or family life or whatever, are they an alcoholic? Are they an abuser? Are they a misuser?
Yeah, I don't think we would. I don't think a clinician would categorize them as a full-blown alcoholic. I think they would certainly look in that misuse or abuse category. And again, it depends on the individual. Certainly, there are other symptoms that happen with people prone to alcoholism that are unique, such as blackouts, where people drink to the point and they lose memory, they lose time, wake up the next morning, have no idea that what took place that night. That's a particular marker that potentially they run the risk of moving more into the alcoholism category than just abuse or misuse.
Well, and Cheryl Pacapelli, I want to bring you into this, not only as a professional, again, Director of Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, but also somebody that has lived this yourself. How do you define this continuum that Tim is talking about?
You know, first I want to just say that I'm a person in long-term recovery since June 28, 1989.
Wow, that's a long time.
For 25 years I've been in recovery, but early on I was first in high school, could be categorized as a binge drinker on the weekends. And as time went on, alcohol became part of my daily life. So I agree 100% with what Tim said, that, you know, it's a spectrum of things. And I know that people that were in my life at that time, at some point, they just stopped. I couldn't stop. Even when I wanted to stop, there were many days that I said, you know, this is the last time I'm doing this, the negative impacts, my family, my, you know, job, all these things were being affected. But yet, I couldn't stop the next day. As many promises as I made to myself, I was not able to stop.
What does that feel like, Cheryl, not able to stop?
Oh, my God. It's so hopeless. You really feel like there's no way out. And what happened to me was, you know, I'll talk about, you know, I used from maybe age 14 till 29. And the last day, I had a bottle of vodka, some pills, and some cocaine, and I just couldn't stop using it. And I had a 2.5-year-old son at the time.
So he's in danger.
He was asleep. And at around 4 o'clock in the morning, I called and I asked for help. And I was lucky enough to get into treatment within 3 hours. And that was the last day that I used. But I didn't even know at that time that there was help for this. I had no idea of a 12-step program, had never heard of anything. I had no idea there were treatment programs. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just couldn't stop getting high. And drinking was a daily. So at that time, once I was introduced to that, it was like all of a sudden, like I had a chance. And I was able to have a full 7-day detox and a full 28-day program, which is, you know, almost unheard of today. And by doing that, I was introduced to 12-step programs and a new social network of people that allowed me to achieve what I have today. I still do the same things that I learned in that first 30 days to maintain and sustain my recovery today.
Wow. Well, that's an amazing story. And thank you for sharing that with us on the air. And I have a couple questions coming out of that. And I'm sure there's other pieces that'll come up this hour. Tim, one thing that really strikes me about what Cheryl says is she started in high school, and we've learned a lot just in the last couple years about brain science, the developing brain. How have these pretty recent discoveries about brain science shed new light on our understanding of alcoholism?
Sure. And I think it's much the same as it is with other substances, particularly around, to Cheryl's point, you know, her story beginning in adolescence. And we know that young people, you know, the prefrontal part of the brain that focuses on critical thinking and decision making isn't fully developed. The rest of the brain is still very much in development throughout adolescence. So you take a chemical like alcohol, which impacts the brain's functioning, slows down some things, and put it in an underdeveloped brain. And there are implications around how the brain continues to form itself to become accustomed to managing the exposure to that substance over time. And that's very much true for alcohol, which is why, you know, when we look at the drinking age, 21 is not an arbitrary number. A lot of people think it is.
It used to be 18.
It used to be 18. When the drinking age was raised, part of the reason it was raised is because at the time, what we knew about brain science is that the human brain took about 21 years to reach full maturity. So if an individual does not begin drinking alcohol until they hit 21, because their brain is fully matured, their brain is less likely to negatively react to that exposure in a way that would drive them towards alcohol abuse or alcoholism. We now, of course, know actually brain science is beginning to tell us that the brain doesn't really finish developing until 25, which is why we are getting paying real attention to particularly drinking and alcohol exposure in college and college campuses, that it's not like someone could be 21 and we just wipe our hands of it. So very much so, looking at the way in which the brain is developing and the exposure to alcohol in an underdeveloped brain increases the likelihood that folks will develop some of these problems down the line, as Cheryl spoke to. And I think Cheryl's story is reflective of the vast majority of individuals who are in recovery from alcoholism who will tell you that they started in adolescence.
And yet, Cheryl also told us, and this gets to the brain science, you know, that some of the people she was with could stop and she couldn't. So I do wonder if different brains react differently.
Sure. And, you know, I think that's an area of brain science and addiction science where we don't quite have the answer yet in terms of why is it that two individuals can be exposed to the same substance, potentially at the same dose, same level, and one develops, goes down a path of developing alcoholism, and one just wakes up one morning and stops. You know, there are 23 million Americans in recovery, and not all 23 million Americans found recovery through a clinical treatment program. Some found it in 12 steps. Some found it on their own. And what the difference is there in individuals' brains, we're not quite sure what that is yet.
All right. We'll definitely talk about treatment options. I'm guessing that a lot of people in Hampshire don't get immediate treatment like you did, Cheryl. So we'll talk about that after a short break. And take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're taking another look at alcoholism, an old problem in the Granite State and around the country. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at new possible treatment options, also what emerging brain science tells us about alcoholism, who might end up with this condition and who won't. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. If you know someone, if you yourself have struggled with this issue, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Cheryl, just going back to your own story, but also your work with people at Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. So you talked about treatment and you were really lucky. You got treatment within 3 hours. You made that phone call. You said, help me, help me. I'm a mom of a young son and I need help. What was that treatment like? How does it start? And it sounds so simple, but how do you stay with it so that you don't go back to your old bad ways?
That's a great question, Laura. And what I can tell you is that it's the only thing I've done for 25 years. I've never been able to exercise consistently, quit smoking consistently, eat right consistently. So I, for me, it was about the fellowship that occurred, that people all trying to do the same thing until midnight tonight. That's what I do. I
day by
stay
day.
In recovery until midnight. That's all I do. I've done that since June 28th. Now, treatment for me was a whole new experience because, you know, I had a what I would call a high bottom. I still had a job. I still had a house. I had a child that I had custody of. And when I got to treatment, I was with people whose bottoms were much lower than me.
They had lost a lot more than you had.
Yes. And at first, I thought I was different. Like this, I'm not that, you know. And but the reality was we were exactly the same. So treatment taught me that I had a disease, not a moral deficiency, which is what a lot of people think. And that together, this group could help each other to stay in the recovery process.
Did treatment involve anything else besides AA and that fellowship and hearing other people's stories?
Oh, it encompassed many different things. Individual counseling, group counseling, art therapy, treatment after treatment where you were still engaged for, I was still engaged for over a year with the treatment facility that I went to, as well as suggestions to go to a 12-step fellowship. So at that time, that's all I was available. Today, there's many different pathways into recovery that I don't weren't available in 1989. So I think
anything
that,
medical, Cheryl? Any drugs that helped you avoid cravings or anything? Or was it more? And I don't mean this is a put down, but was there anything in medical in addition to the talking part and the fellowship part and the human support part?
For me, it was just a depression and anxiety that went along with not having a substance any longer in my body. But, and today there are medical drugs that can help people to get through that. Back in 1989, those weren't available.
Yeah.
So I support absolutely whatever it takes to make your life better.
Do you want to jump in there, Tim, what treatment looks like today? And it's an interesting point to hear Cheryl talk about it. Back in 89, that was a while ago, the options were more limited.
Yeah. And I mean, from an access standpoint, generally, our options are still limited. But I do think that there has been, to Cheryl's point, the increased availability of medication-assisted treatment. That there are medications, there's one specifically for alcoholism that can help folks who reduce their cravings, sort of manage some of the after effects of withdrawal. And the emergent science has been pretty clear that those medications, and again, they're assistive. So you take those medications while you are engaged in traditional psychotherapy techniques, that people's outcomes tend to be better when they're provided that kind of medication support for a lot of folks suffering, again, from alcoholism. And then there's medically assisted treatment that we've talked about before for opiates. But that is a relatively new phenomenon. And I think that's been the biggest new development over the last decade, in addition to, I think, an improved understanding of what kinds of clinical psychotherapy practices work best with folks.
Well, and as we talk more about treatment and get into this thorny question of what works, what's most effective for the most people, I want to bring two voices into our conversation. First, we're going to talk to Dr. Lance Dodis. He's a retired assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, author of the book The Sober Truth, Debunking the Bad Science Behind 12-Step Programs in the Rehab Industry. And Dr. Dodis, thanks a lot for taking time out for us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's say a patient comes to you and says, Dr. Dodis, I think I have a drinking problem. You determine that he or she does. What do you do for him?
Well, since this is a symptom, he's a compulsive drinker, he's telling me. Let's assume that it's true, that his self-diagnosis is accurate. Well, then the first question that comes to mind of anybody who's psychologically trained is, let's see if we can understand what it is that makes you compulsively drink. This is separate from somebody who has a physical addiction where you have to first medically detox real question is, what is it that drives this compulsion to drink? And also, when you understand that, why does it occur when it does? It's certainly not a random act. We all agree on that. People don't drink just because it's 2 in the afternoon. They drink because something has occurred in their lives, some loss, some stress, some anxiety, some humiliation, something. People have reasons that they do whatever they do, whether it's drinking or it's some other compulsive behavior like gambling or eating.
So it's a psychological component. Is there a medical component too, though, Dr. Dotis?
Well, the medical component comes in with drugs when you are physically addicted to them. So obviously we all know that if you take, for example, heroin for a long time, very pure heroin, let's say, for a very long time, of course you will be physically addicted. But that requires detoxification. I mean, you can do it without medical help, but it's very painful. So you go in to a hospital, you get the appropriate drug to detoxify you, and depending on your condition, within a matter of days or a week, you're off it. Once you're off it, you're off it. Now, that doesn't cure the problem, but that does take care of the medical piece of it. So at that point, you're now ready to look at what the problem is, why it's occurring.
Well, you've written a book, and I read the subtitle of it, coming out pretty strongly against Alcoholics Anonymous. And we could talk for a whole hour about this, Dr. Dotis, but what are your chief concerns about AA?
Well, the main issue is that it's not really AA's fault exactly, but everyone in the country believes that AA is the first and best treatment. And that's because we hear from the people for whom it was the first and best treatment. I know your previous caller did wonderfully in AA, and that's terrific. But the problem is that if you look at the studies, which is what we did in the book, the percentage of people who do well in AA is about 5 to 10% of all the people who go to AA. And no one knows that. Everyone thinks that it's almost 100% because that's what AA claimed 70 years ago, and people still believe that. So I'm not really a critic of AA in that sense. I think we need AA for the people that it helps. But the injury to people is that we tell them, go to AA, and if you're not doing well, stay in it. And that's a tragedy because we've all known people. I mean, when I say we, I mean everyone in the field knows people who have spent years or decades of their lives drinking, trying to get well in a 12-step program, which will never help them because it just doesn't work for 90% of the people.
So you're saying we need more options for folks?
We certainly do, and there are more options, as people were saying on your show. There are harm reduction programs. There's something called the HAMS Network. There's Life Ring. There's a program out in San Diego called Practical Recovery. There's Smart Recovery. There are many non-abstinence programs which are helpful. And, of course, the other thing, which is what I've spent most of my career writing about, is trying to understand the psychology behind it. And we don't treat addiction within psychotherapy the way we once did, fortunately. And there are better ways of approaching it based on really understanding how it works. So that's another way you can go. The problem with the science, and I know you're going to have on John Kelly later, is that people have misinterpreted the data. It's not that the people who do the studies are stupid. They themselves know what the problems with it are. But let me summarize it. The problem is that if you look at people over a long time, and the longest study was 16 years, you find that the people who are still in AA after a long time are the people who are doing best. But there's a logical flaw, and that is that you are then looking only at the people who are doing well. You're looking at the people in that 5 to 10% range. And they all, these studies all conclude, and all most of the researchers make this mistake, they then conclude that everybody should stay a long time because those people did well. Whereas actually, the conclusion should be only those people who do well do well. Everyone else should get out.
You know, you said something interesting, Dr. Dotis, non-abstinence programs. And, you know, most people know that AA says, you know, you are not to drink at all, that for an alcoholic, there is no drinking in moderation. Are there programs that help people curb a drinking problem without saying, you know, you can never have another, you know, glass of wine at a wedding?
Oh, absolutely. All those programs I mentioned do exactly that. They're not, their goal is not to be abstinent, not that they have anything against abstinence. No one has anything against that. But that they're saying, look, it may be an unrealistic goal for many people. And instead of insisting that that's how you define success and turning away people or telling them that they're failing if they don't achieve abstinence, it can be very helpful to have this kind of harm reduction approach, which is, it's not AA's approach, of course.
Okay. Dr. Dodis, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking time out for us today.
Sure.
That's Dr. Lance Dodis, retired assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. The number for you to join us today in the exchange as we look once again at alcoholism, a new look at an old, old, old problem, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Tim Rourke, Cheryl Pacapelli, lots of feedback from our listeners, emails, Facebook comments, calls, and so forth. But I did want to take just a moment and ask both of you about some of the scrutiny that AA has come under. Tim Rourke, to you first, just the idea that this doesn't work for a lot of people, and yet most people think that's the you know, only and best option. So they're going to AA, it's not working, and they keep, quote-unquote, falling off the wagon.
I think that, and some of what Dr. Dodis says in some of his work, I think is relevant here, the extent to which we have seen over time, and particularly in New Hampshire, where we have such limited access to other levels of treatment, that 12-step becomes a default because there isn't another option. So I know he writes a lot about judges who mandate people go to AA as a part of their court engagement, things of that nature. We're looking at justice reform around, we need to understand, do better assessments to understand the nature of people's addiction so that they can be pointed to the right care for them. This is a complicated, complex illness like a lot of other chronic illnesses like cancer or diabetes. And, you know, with cancer treatment, there's not just one treatment. We look at that individual's particular disease. We look at that individual's particular pattern and clinically assess, here are some treatment modalities that are likely to work for that individual. I think because of the expansion of more clinical alternatives, medication-assisted treatment, as I said, and others, we should be moving as a field to including 12-step as an important component because it does work for those who it works well with. But how do we make sure we're doing appropriate assessments and guiding people towards a service that works for them and not stigmatizing folks if they choose, if they decide, or if there's a clinical assessment that maybe medication is what's best for that individual or maybe 12-step is what's best. I think the work of the recovery organization that Cheryl is with, around really embracing all pathways to recovery, is important because there is, if there was a silver bullet, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
There is no cure for this illness. There are multiple ways in which to treat it, to mitigate its negative outcomes, but we need to, and I think science and good practice is allowing us to get better at assessing the individual's needs and making some determinations based on the course of an individual's trajectory to decide what kind of treatment modality is best. I do think, again, in New Hampshire, we've struggled because there has not been a lot of treatment alternatives available. So 12-step has become the default.
Especially in this state where we don't have a lot of resources. And AA is free.
Correct. And it's generally speaking, pretty easily available and accessible. Unfortunately, though, I think that does create a paradigm where people, you know, a judge orders you there with really no understanding of whether or not that's the best treatment for that individual. But we order them there because there is just this perception that there's nothing else or a perception that it works for everybody. So I think it's about better communication and really taking advantage of who it works for and making sure there are alternatives for those for whom that's just not a modality that resonates with them.
Who doesn't it work for, Cheryl? And I know you said earlier you are not here to say AA is the only way. It was great for you. I've got a stack of emails from folks who say it was great for them. But who doesn't it work for?
You know, that's really hard to answer. I know that the people that I know through going to 12-step programs, the people that embrace the program fully and understand its core principles of, you know, that we don't use for one day. That's all we do here. And as you do that, your life will get better. Now, I also believe that there's many different ways to get into recovery. And as soon as we start asking people, what will your recovery look like, is when we're going to start being able to combat this. Because what I needed to stay in recovery was much different than what my son needed when he got into recovery. Way different. But we treat it all the same. It's like a little cookie cutter, and not everything works for everybody. So I think that we need to start treating this like Tim talked about, like somebody that has cancer. When my aunt had lung cancer, she didn't get treatment for brain cancer. She got treatment for lung cancer. So what is it that that individual needs, whether they need housing supports or they have a house or they need a job? What does that look like? And that's how we'll be able to help people.
All right. So many people who want to jump in our conversation. Here's Deidre from Facebook. Many people attend AA meetings either ordered to do so by a court, as you both said, or to satisfy family or to show a judge in an attempt to reduce a penalty for a DUI. Deidre says these people aren't motivated toward recovery. They are out to prevent some larger penalty. Proper motivation is important in recovery, and preventing some other penalty rather than wanting sobriety for the sake of sobriety isn't the proper motivation. So that's what you touched on before, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, what happened to me personally was they told me to go to a 12-step meeting, and I was like, I don't want to do this. But over time, I was like, my God, this is saving my life. So I had no motivation to be there. I was going to keep my job. I was going to keep my child. But I continued to go because that was the suggestion. Do this. And after 90 days or 6 months, I was like, wow, this is really great. So I think that we can't dismiss the fact that if people stay there, even if they're court ordered, that there is some benefit to their life.
Well, and Deidre, thank you for the Facebook comment. She also says going to AA meetings is not, quote, doing AA. The actual program of AA is the steps. Going to an endocrinologist isn't going to help diabetes if you refuse to take insulin. Deidre says going to AA meetings doesn't help if you don't do the steps. Deidre, thank you. Lots more comments after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about alcohol addiction. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're looking at this old problem with some new information about expanding treatment options and also what brain science these days is telling us about alcohol and alcohol addiction. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Tim Rourke, Cheryl Pacapelli, let's go to our listeners again. And William's calling in from New London. Hi, William, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, I just was part of a program over in New York called, it's not called anything really. It's St. Jude's, and it's a CBL, cognitive behavioral learning experience, and it was far more successful than any AA process that I even tried to experience. I mean, the tenets are the same: is just don't drink. That's pretty simple. Is in that aspect, but the CBL is a high value, low value choice making system. It was a 6-week program, and for me, it was fantastic. It is not even discussed. It's not paid for by insurance. It is unsupported. So that's one of the reasons you don't hear of these other programs that are actually more successful. CBL or St. Jude's says they have a 60% success rate, whereas the AA has the 5-10 as the other.
William, I'll ask you two questions, please, and thank you so much for calling in. When you said cognitive behavioral therapy is unsupported, what do you mean by that?
Well, it gets therapeutic support. It doesn't get support as far as a treatment option for addiction. And that includes both opiate addiction. It includes all addictions because it's a way of thinking versus a way of it's a way of reprocessing your brain. And that's another aspect of CBT, is that your neuroplasticity is a big up and coming belief system that we used to think your brain was fixed at 25
right,
or 21 or 18. It is not. That is categorically a lie.
Right, and I've read a lot about that. And as someone who's past age 25, it's welcome news. So when you say supported, you mean not covered by insurance? Is that
not
what you're saying?
Not covered by insurance, okay. And not spoken about. You know, you really have to dig. I mean, these places are taking upwards of $30,000 from you, and you're walking out with a 10% success rate. I don't see that as a real quality, and then insurance covers that.
Okay.
The program I went to was 15 and wasn't covered, and yet I'm successful, so now I'm not really a problem to the healthcare system, and there's tons of AA people out there being told, go, just keep going.
All right. William, thank you for calling in. Tim, do you want to jump in real quick?
Sure. And congratulations on your recovery, William. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is one of those evidence-based therapeutic psychological interventions that is in showing real efficacy in the substance use community. And certainly in New Hampshire, relative to our substance abuse treatment system, CBT is a pretty widely used modality. And as we've talked about on the show before, we have a substance abuse benefit in our health protection program for Medicaid that includes coverage of clinical services that include clinicians who provide CBT. So we're lucky in our state. And again, I think that's an example of that sort of psychological underpinning, even as Cheryl shares her recovery story, where, you know, you detox and get off of that medication, but then part of the treatment gets into understanding thinking patterns, understanding decision making, remembering the brain science that if we freeze an adolescent brain, you start using as an adolescent where those decision making points aren't fully developed. CBT is one of those things that can help an adult learn what they didn't learn through normal adolescent development, which is some of those decision-making trees. So CBT is something in wide use in clinical practices in the state of New Hampshire,
okay.
And it is covered.
So, and it gets back to what we talked about earlier, Tim, you know, again, emerging brain science. He's right. We used to think that, you know, past 30 or whatever, your brain was kind of frozen in time. CBT shows us that, no, that's not the case.
Correct.
You can, through the right approach, unlock this.
Correct. And I should add, too, that, you know, when we talk about the efficacy of 12-step programs, that there are some who that 12-step is all they do. There are others who may engage in CBT or clinical psychotherapy and augment and support their recovery through additional engagement in 12-step. So I think sometimes some of these modalities actually come together to complement someone's positive outcomes.
All right. Well, and we're going to bring another voice into our conversation who's been looking a lot at this issue of what is the right treatment for the right person. John Kelly is with us now. He's an associate professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Harvard Medical School. John Kelly, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Well, so if someone comes to you with concerns about a drinking problem, we've been talking a lot this hour already about, you know, there's no one size fits all. What do you do for that person if they say, you know, John, I'm really worried about my drinking?
Well, the first thing to do is do a comprehensive assessment to find out exactly the nature, scope, duration, and onset of the alcohol-related problem, and also the other kinds of problems that individual may be suffering from. These could be co-occurring psychiatric symptoms and syndromes, as well as other kinds of medical problems. So it's very important to do comprehensive assessment to place this in context, as well as look at its severity and impact in that person's life. And then with that assessment done properly, using ideally a validated measure to be able to do that, then you can, you know, begin to make recommendations about what kinds of approaches may be best for that individual. There is, as your guests have been saying, a spectrum of severity and impact that these problems have, ranging from misuse to hazardous and harmful use to very severe addiction, which takes about 100,000 lives every year in this country.
What do you think about the question that we've been pondering this hour, John, that AA has for so long dominated the alcohol treatment scene, that people aren't aware of other options, they're not given other options? If AA doesn't work for them, they feel like they're an utter failure and forget it, they'll never be helped. What do you think about that dominance of AA in our treatment culture?
It is still dominant. I think there are more other kinds of treatments now coming online and getting on people's radar screen, including other kinds of therapies, as well as FDA-approved medications. You know, we have 3 FDA-approved medications for alcohol dependence, and we will have more soon probably coming on line, being FDA approved as well. Now, this doesn't mean that AA and 12-step approaches are old-fashioned and should be ignored. In fact, you know, what happened in the last 25 years is, following a report by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, which was published in 1990, which actually asked to broaden the base of treatment for alcohol problems. That was the purpose of the report. What it called for was more research on AA and 12-step treatment, because the kind of evidence base up to that point was judged to be methodologically poor. And so what that did, because the Institute of Medicine is a very highfalutin, prestigious body, it actually legitimized serious scientific investigation into AA and 12-step treatment. In the intervening 25 years, we've had a lot of randomized controlled trials which have demonstrated that 12-step approaches are actually, and surprisingly to many people, as good, if not better, than other kinds of approaches. And here's why, is because 12-step approaches that have been looked at in these randomized controlled trials, most of them NIH-sponsored, they facilitate engagement in these community-based resources, which are shown, what we've learned is that they mobilize, so groups like AA mobilize the same kinds of psychological processes that are mobilized by formal treatment. That is to say, they enhance motivation for recovery and maintain it over time, because we're talking about a chronic illness. They also boost people's coping skills and their confidence, and they help people manage stress. And these are the things that we've learned, why these groups seem to confer benefit over time. And for treatments that actually incorporate this kind of 12-step facilitation and encourage engagement in these free community resources, they tend to have better outcomes of a magnitude of about 10 to 20%.
So it's not the only option, and it shouldn't be the solo option, but you're saying, John, it should be, for a lot of folks, an option. That peer
yes,
support is
absolutely.
Really helpful.
Peer support is actually surprisingly very powerful.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
John Kelly, Associate Professor of Psychiatry in the Addiction Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Tim and Cheryl, so many emails here. I just want to share a couple of them with you and get your thoughts. Here's Dean responding to Dr. Dotus's comments, who we heard earlier, about AA. Dean says, it's important to note that 12-step programs and fellowships are more often than not the last method a person seeking recovery will put effort into after exhausting other methods. Dean also says, but recent evidence shows that peer-based models are incredibly effective for maintaining sobriety, especially in lieu of treatment that is hardly accessible in our state. Dean says, what efforts are underway in New Hampshire to expand free peer-based support? So here's Dean saying, you know, this is good for keeping you on the right path. I wonder what you think, Cheryl.
I would agree with Dean that once initiated into recovery, peer-based support is something that can enhance someone's recovery, keep them engaged. So some of those type of services could be recovery coaching, telephone recovery support, just a little quick call. How's your recovery going? Are you going to meetings? Where are you at? Where, once again, everybody's pathway is unique and supported.
Here's another email from Thomas. He says, AA, 12-step, CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy that one of our earlier callers mentioned. Thomas says, AA, 12-step, and CBT are no better than taking a placebo. Any other medical treatment would be banned by the FDA. Would you rather take a placebo or a Motrin for your arthritis? He says, it's time to treat alcoholism as a medical problem. It's time for physicians to use drugs like naltrexone, you're going to have to help me pronounce that one, Tim, to start using the recommended and effective treatment. He says, the Come to Jesus movement and the shamans have no place in alcoholism treatment. This is a broad criticism that is made, Tim, when folks don't have access to anything but AA, that if alcoholism is medical, let's treat it medically.
Sure. And naltrexone is one of those medications that John referred to that is medically assisted treatment. But again, if you look at the research outcomes on patients who take naltrexone, when it's most effective, they are taking naltrexone while they are also receiving treatment, talk therapy, psychotherapy, may be involved in 12-step or ongoing recovery support. So the science is really clear that the medication in and of itself is not as effective as medication tied to engaging in what we consider sort of more traditional treatment modalities. And that's where you get that outcome. So it is very much a way to embrace the integrated nature of how to treat this disorder.
Let's take another call. This is Stephanie in New Durham. Hi, Stephanie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey. My question or comment is that my sister is currently about 5 months sober through AA. And one of the things that she has done to try to manage her addiction to alcohol is not officially encouraged by AA, but is kind of supported by the members that she sees routinely. And it's to kind of swap one addiction for another. So she's been using marijuana very heavily to try to curb her addiction for the alcohol craving. So my question, and I understand that AA does not encourage that, but amongst its members, she says it's very common.
Wow, so Stephanie, yeah. It's a good question and a little concerning. She goes to AA, Cheryl, to get help with her drinking, and then people are saying, hey, try marijuana to help reduce your cravings.
That hasn't been my experience in 12-step programs that are typically abstinent-based.
Abstinence from all
substances.
Substances.
So that's not to say there aren't other recovery programs out there that might be okay at.
Tim.
And I would just echo, and I know we've had shows on this topic before, but marijuana is a drug. It is addictive for some. I think switching one drug for another is not necessarily in the best long-term benefit to the individual. So I would sort of caution against that. I do think, however, there are folks who may, because going back to this idea of the compulsive nature of this, the addictive nature of an individual that may drive them to do things, you know, there are folks who have, you know, found sobriety and recovery by engaging deeply in exercise and becoming, you know, ultra distance runners and things like that. So there are ways you could certainly potentially trade a healthier activity to be to sustain yourself and still meet sort of a compulsive need. But by the same token, I think you've got to do that very carefully because switching one drug for another doesn't necessarily offer you long-term benefit.
Well, and it also gets to the point – thank you for the call. It gets to the point that every meeting is so different, right, Cheryl? I mean, every group has its own dynamic.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, one of the suggestions that was made to me was to go to a meeting 6 times before you made a decision if that was a good meeting for you. Because of just that, the group dynamics change, or there's meetings for just women or just men or speaker meetings. There's all different types of meetings. So you have to find what works for you.
Yeah, it's not homogenous.
Correct.
Well, and to that point, here's an email that came in before the show. Someone who didn't want their name used from Temple. This person says, writing from experience, I know that sometimes AA isn't helpful at all. During 22 years as an active alcoholic, I tried AA 3 different times before I found a meeting that worked for me. This person says, the very first time I went to an AA meeting, the whole experience seemed so ridiculous. All I wanted to do after it ended was go get a drink. But then this person goes on to say, if you really want to get sober and you want to try AA, you must know that the chemistry of each meeting group is different, and what works for one person may not work for another. It is a mistake for the public at large and the media to discuss AA as a homogenous group or a single format process. And this person goes on to say a lot more, but that gets to that. Gets to that point. Here's another email. This is from Chip in the Keene area. He says, what is usually not heard is there is much is the spiritual side of the program. It is one option for those seeking help. And the framework, which has evolved over decades, works well in a state that is miserly with addiction services. This is a hopeful safety net. I mean, that's something that we haven't talked as much about this hour, Tim, but it's free. And that's one thing about AA. I wonder, though, because it's free, does that make insurance providers, the state, whoever, think that, all right, they're off the hook. They can always go to AA.
I don't think so. And I think that's the conversation that's emerging right now. Is we recognize it works for some people. It doesn't work for others. And we need to make other treatments available in our state and provide more options and better patient education so patients, clients, folks who are struggling with this disorder can make informed decisions around where they feel they could get the best support to meet their individual circumstance. And again, maybe that's an AA group. Maybe it's a 12-step group that's got a much more spiritual or religious bent. Maybe it's a group that doesn't have some of those higher power elements that for some people doesn't resonate. Or maybe it's, again, inpatient treatment or outpatient counselor who they can meet with once a week or group therapy. So we need to do better in terms of funding that array and then educating patients so they can make informed decisions.
All right. Both of you, thank you very much for being here. Tim, thank you very much for your time.
You.
And Cheryl, thank you also. It was good to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Knoy.